got to be kidding me. Are we really having this discussion right now? That we're going to start back over?
Patience is at a premium on day two of the special session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, more small companies are drilling for oil and gas in Alaska, and some are racking up big fines for not following state rules.
You can only be the new kid on the block so long before you start having to be responsible for your behavior.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska Native elders and Arctic scientists explore climate change at Science of the Land Camp in Fairbanks, June 14 to 17. Travel grant deadline May 24 at ainealaska.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Interior Native Educators.
In the debate over how to close Alaska's nearly $4 billion budget hole, one issue that hasn't gotten much attention, new sources of revenue. That was supposed to be a major focus of the special session happening now. But in the first committee hearing this week, lawmakers panned Governor Bill Walker's plan to raise taxes on everything from fishing and mining to alcohol, tobacco, and motor fuel, plus, of course, an income tax. Walker originally introduced the bills as separate bills. Those went nowhere in the regular session. This time, he rolled them into a single bill. Eagle River Republican Dan Sadler put this question to Revenue Commissioner Randy Hoffbeck.
Did you think that ganging together seven different taxes was going to make it more likely or less likely that any of them be passed?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, based on the success that we had passing them as individual bills, it's probably not less likely.
Meanwhile, both houses voted unanimously to resurrect all the bills from last session, avoiding an alternative that would have forced them to start from scratch. House Democrats did want to start over on one bill, the overhaul of oil and gas taxes. That proposal was met with disbelief. Here's Anchorage Republican Lance Pruitt.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me. Are we really having this discussion right now? That we're going to start back over? Imagine how I'm going to go back and talk about this to my constituents. They're already not happy that we couldn't do our work in 90 days, not happy that we couldn't do it in 120 days. We've decided we're going to start over on one of the biggest, most complex, most controversial issues that we have.
That proposal was voted down. At the end of the House session, Minority Leader Chris Tuck, an Anchorage Democrat, rose to address an issue close to the hearts of lawmakers and staff who find themselves more than 30 days past their original end date.
Thank you, Ms. Speaker. Subject is hang in there.
Mr. Minority Leader.
I know many of us are sick and tired, but hang in there. We'll get through it. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Lawmakers have only two committee meetings scheduled for tomorrow, day three of the special session. Last year was a record year for fines in Alaska's oil and gas fields. State regulators proposed some $1.7 million in penalties against five companies and the University of Alaska Fairbanks for violating safety and environmental regulations at oil and gas wells. One reason for the increase? More and smaller operators entering a state long dominated by a handful of major players. The largest violator in recent years has been the company Hillcorp, which has revitalized gas production in Cook Inlet and expanded into the North Slope while racking up more than $1 million in proposed fines. APRN's Rachel Waldholz reports.
Last September, three contractors nearly died while working on a well at Hillcorp's Milne Point unit on the North Slope. The three men were knocked unconscious when nitrogen filled the trailer where they were working. All three recovered. But an investigation by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which regulates the state's wells, found that the incident would have been fatal if one of the workers hadn't been lucky enough to collapse in the fresh air outside the trailer. The commission found that Hillcorp had violated state regulations at the site, and it wasn't the first time. In a letter, the commission wrote, "The disregard for regulatory compliance is endemic to Hillcorp's approach and virtually assured the occurrence of the incident that injured the three workers." Regulators proposed a $720,000 fine, adding, "Hillcorp's conduct is inexcusable."
So who wrote that? that was a team effort.
That's Kathy Forster, one of the agency's two commissioners. This spring, the commission posted a list of all the penalties it's imposed since 1976, about 30 in all. More than a third of those were logged last year. Forster says that's in part because of more enforcement, but it's also been driven by a shift in Alaska's oil fields as newer companies have entered the state.
As we get in smaller operators and new operators that aren't familiar with Alaska regulations, we've had some operators who've used a learn-as-you-go approach to regulatory compliance, which I frown upon.
Forster is quick to add that not all small operators have trouble following the rules. And the largest penalty ever recorded wasn't for a small company at all. It was a $1.3 million fine against BP for an explosion and fire that injured a worker in 2002. But of the 11 fines proposed last year, 10 were for smaller companies. Larry Pursley is an oil and gas advisor to the Kenai Peninsula Borough. He says it may be too early to call it a trend, but if it continues, it's not unique to Alaska.
Looking around the country, smaller operators, which is what we're seeing more of in Alaska, particularly Cook Inlet, smaller operators tend to get cited on compliance issues more than the major oil and gas producers.
Pursley says smaller companies may not have the resources, the expertise, the staff, or the emphasis on following the rules. And most fines aren't for incidents that cause environmental damage or injure workers. Reading through the list of penalties can feel like going through a stack of parking tickets, citations for failing to provide reports or failing to test or install the right equipment. But that's exactly what the commission should be focused on, Pursley says.
It's good governance on the part of the state and the industry to have zero tolerance for any errors, any violations, because things go bad, they really go bad.
That appears to be the commission's concern about Hillcorp, which accounted for 6 of the 11 penalties proposed last year. Since entering Alaska in 2011, Hillcorp has taken over fields from bigger players in Cook Inlet and the North Slope, becoming a significant oil producer and the inlet's largest natural gas producer. In the process, it's been hit with over $1 million in proposed fines. Forster wouldn't comment on specific incidents because most of those penalties are still being appealed, but she says she stands by the commission's written statements.
In their early time, we didn't send out any notices of violation or notices of enforcement. Instead, we chose to educate them. But you can only be the new kid on the block so long before you start having to be responsible for your behavior.
Representatives from Hillcorp itself declined to be interviewed. In an emailed statement, David Wilkins, Hillcorp Alaska's senior vice president, wrote, "We take regulatory compliance issues seriously. We are working to improve communications and understanding with all of our regulators, including the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission." Forster says her team believes Hillcorp is serious about changing how it operates going forward. And she says the solutions are pretty simple.
Regulatory compliance isn't that difficult. You have to prioritize it, you have to incentivize it, and you have to equip for it.
The real key, she says, is for companies to make it clear to their employees that following the rules is non-negotiable. From the Energy Desk, with help from Hannah Craig and Eric Keto in Anchorage, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Juneau.
You can find a full list of penalties broken down by company on our website at alaskapublic.org. President Obama has signed a bill that removes the words Oriental, Eskimo, and Aleut from two federal programs. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the new law does not erase Eskimo and Aleut from other U.S. laws.
The bill's sponsor, Democratic Congresswoman Grace Meng of New York, says she wanted to remove from U.S. code the last two instances of the term Oriental. Times have changed, Meng says, and many Asian Americans find the word offensive.
In the same way, I would not want either of my children to be referred to as Orientals by their teachers at school. I hope we can agree that such terms no longer deserve a place in federal law.
Her bill revises the names of ethnic groups in two programs, both in the Energy Department, that date from the 1970s. Instead of Negro, Oriental, Eskimo, and Aleut, those laws will now refer to African Americans, Asian Americans, and Alaska Natives. Many Asian Americans object to being called Oriental. Some say the word emphasizes exoticism and was used to exclude. Eskimo and Aleut are less controversial. Some Alaskans prefer more indigenous or specific terms, but the tags still appear in the names of organizations, like the Nome Eskimo Community and the Aleut Corporation. Both Eskimo and Aleut are still used about 100 times in other federal statutes, dealing with everything from art and culture grants to fur seal management. Congressman Don Young's spokesman, Matt Shukro, says Young uses the term Alaska Native in legislation. Updating older laws can help with legislative consistency, Shukro said, adding that Young respects the choices of Native people and organizations to choose their own terms of identification. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a man who survived a brown bear mauling describes his panic during the attack.
And I just remember thinking, this bear is going to swallow me whole. He's going to eat me and walk away, and nobody's ever going to find me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
The survivor of a brown bear mauling near Yakutat 10 days ago says the animal was startled and attacked instinctively. Ken Steck is recovering from his wounds with family in Anchorage. He spoke recently with KCAW's Robert Woolsey about his experience.
Some of the early official reports of Kenny Steck's encounter with a brown bear in Disenchantment Bay on May 13th indicated that he had a gun when the bear charged but did not have time to use it. That's not quite right.
For a lot of reasons, and I'm not exactly sure why, but really didn't even think twice about bringing a weapon or bringing the bear mace.
Steck had camped overnight on a gravel bar with seven other people. Given the noise and disturbance that a party of this size makes, he didn't think it necessary to bring one of the two hunting rifles on his 200-yard walk to fetch water. But a gun may not have made any difference. The bear stood up in the brush around 30 yards away and went on the move.
When I heard the bear, I turned around, and it was already running at me three quarters, if not full speed. And, I keep replaying the scenario in my head. Even if I had a rifle, especially around my back that was slung, I don't know if I would have had enough time to get it off my back, put a round in the chamber, and place a well-aimed shot.
In some ways, Steck says it was a by-the-book brown bear attack. At least it seems that way in hindsight.
I feel like the bear saw me as a threat, and it took me down. And once it realized that I wasn't as tough as it thought I was, it took off and didn't want anything to do with me.
Steck estimates that the bear was on him for about 20 seconds, though he has no way of knowing for sure. Steck is a military veteran. He spent 4 years in active duty in the Marine Corps as a firefighter and EMT. After leaving the Marines, he served in the same capacity as a civilian in Iraq for 14 months in Kirkuk, about 100 miles north of Baghdad. He says he was scared sometimes doing that work, but nothing comes close to his experience with the bear. Steck says that during the encounter itself, his fear was almost irrational.
I do remember when the bear had my head in its mouth. My brain obviously was in shock. My body was in shock. And I just remember thinking, this bear is going to swallow me whole. He's going to eat me and walk away, and nobody's ever going to find me. You know, I was kind of thinking crazy thoughts, you know, and obviously the bear wouldn't be able to do that. But I did. I thought the bear was just going to take me and nobody would ever find me, and I was going to die within the next few seconds.
Steck says the bear left on its own. The other members of his party heard him shouting at the animal but arrived too late. Four of them were nurses. Steck's wife, Hannah, with 8 years' experience in emergency rooms and intensive care units, and his brother-in-law, Isaiah Carlson, and his wife, Heidi, who've worked for the last 3 years at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, and Ellen Ivers, who just graduated from nursing school. Steck jokes that he married into a good family. They provided first aid and transported him the quarter mile along the gravel bar to their boat, and then on the 90-minute return to Yakutat. He's serious, though, that he harbors no ill will toward this bear.
I understand that the bear was just reacting, and, you know, I don't really have any intentions of going to hunt that bear and wanting to kill the bear.
Steck admits that he might have been a little too complacent going to fetch water that day, and that this encounter will affect the way he hunts and camps and enjoys the outdoors in the future. He's feeling grateful to be alive and a little humbled.
Grace was totally extended to me, and I did nothing to deserve it.
Steck was in transition between jobs in Juneau and Glen Allen when the attack occurred. He says his new employers at the Bureau of Land Management are willing to give him time to heal. Steck expects a full recovery in 4 to 6 months. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Two Alaska communities are receiving a federal grant to jumpstart renewable energy projects. Haines and the village of Heidelberg were selected from 77 applicants nationwide. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Over the past 10 years, about 36 biomass systems have been installed in Alaska. The term sounds pretty technical, but it's used to describe a prehistoric way to stay warm, a wood-burning fire.
You know, we're not talking about some smoky old wood stove here. We're talking about high-tech equipment.
That's Dan Parent, a program manager at the U.S. Forest Service. He says the Wood Innovation Grants were awarded to projects that maximize energy efficiency. Typically, the wood comes from second growth or byproducts. It even helps mitigate the threat of wildfire. In the village of Heidelberg, the grant is funding the heat system for the school, which also includes a greenhouse. Cordwood will keep the buildings warm, displacing over 2,400 gallons of heating fuel a year. The total cost is $900,000, with the bulk of the funding coming from the Alaska Energy Authority. In the past decade, Parent says he's seen more cities consider biomass as a viable option.
You know, several years ago, oil prices were through the roof. And that's when a lot of these projects got started and got funded.
Although the price of oil has dropped, that interest has remained.
We are tied on this very fragile supply line to Seattle for our food and our fuel.
Darcy Kolbeck is a biomass consultant to the Haines Borough. A $1.5 million biomass system is in the works that could heat the borough's schools, some public facilities, and a swimming pool with wood chips. Kolbeck says the wood chips could come from the Haines State Forest and stimulate the local economy. On top of that, he thinks the savings could come back to help the borough in a big way.
Budget crisis happens and we lose our art teacher. Can we keep that art teacher because we saved enough money on fuel? That would be awesome.
In 2010, the village of Toke fired up its biomass boiler, and 3 years later, they were saving enough money to add a music teacher and a school counselor. Heidelberg and Haines biomass systems are expected to be completed next year. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN, and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The the Alaska Ocean Observing System recently rolled out a new information hub that's all about beluga whales. The Cook Inlet Beluga Ecosystem Portal is a one-stop shop for beluga data that its creators hope will help scientists and the public make more informed decisions in the future. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
From aerial views of Alaska's coastline to environmental data to social statistics, the new Beluga Ecosystem Portal has a lot of information.
So the intention of the portal is to provide a user-friendly location that anybody from a researcher to an environmental manager to the general public could go and access information that's freely available.
Stacy Buckaloo is a project coordinator with Axiom Data Science, which designed the portal.
It pulls information primarily from the Cook Inlet beluga whale sighting database that was funded by the National Marine Fisheries Service that integrates about 10 years of their aerial surveys of beluga whales, as well as land-based beluga whale surveys by a number of other projects.
The portal also includes environmental data not specific to whales, like ocean temperature trends over time, water salinity stats, and more.
We are expecting that it's really going to help ecosystem-based management.
That's Holly Kent, Director of Administration and Outreach for the Alaska Ocean Observing System, or AOOS.
Like, well, where does the beluga normally hang out, and what time of year, and what kind of ocean conditions are happening, you know, when they're in this particular area, and that might help us to make a plan about when we should have ship traffic going by, for instance, or something like that.
She says there are a few stakeholders AOOS hopes will be able to use the portal immediately, like the Alaska Coastal Impact Assistance Program, Alaska's Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Plan, and the National Fish Habitat Action Plan, among others. Buckaloo says online information hubs like this one have been gaining in popularity for groups like these in recent years.
It's a new way that we're accessing technology in the scientific world, and I think also in the public arena.
And Kent says it's a step in the right direction from the days of calling agency after agency asking the same questions.
So it could take weeks or months to get all that information together, but now anybody in an agency or anywhere else can just go right to our website and they can do all of that.
More information can be found at portal.aoos.org. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Susan Churchill is a Japanese American who grew up in a small town near Seattle not long after World War II. But her experiences growing up were nothing like her father's.
After the war, when he got together with his brothers and bought this property to farm, my father commuted from Falls City, where the farm was, to Seattle the first, I'd say, 5 years that they owned the property, because he felt it was a community of mostly Caucasians. He wanted to make sure it would be safe, really, for his family to move out there. Because of World War II and his experience, people of my parents' generation, which is second generation Japanese Americans, most of them did go through World War II and the internment camps. You know, they were taken away from their property and treated like prisoners because of their, they were easily identified because, you know, it would be harder to be able to round up the Italians and the Germans that lived in the communities on the West Coast and put them into camps. And the first time I realized that my parents were sent to internment camp, I was like 12 or 13 years old. And my father was talking about, oh yeah, my grandfather, when they were given notice that they had to be evacuated and that they could only take what they could carry, had them practice carrying so that they could carry as much as they could to take with them because they were leaving their home and not knowing when they'd ever come back or if they would come back. When they would get together with friends or with family and they talk about fun times, you know, reminiscing, and they talk about, oh, this happened in camp or so-and-so, you know, remember they got married in camp or all these things. And I thought, oh, well, they were talking about church camp, because all the things that they would discuss openly like that were all fun, positive things that happened. And when I would read stories and things, I could start understanding more of why they didn't want to talk about it. Because some of it reverts back to the Japanese values, which is, there's a term, shikata ganai, which is, it can't be helped. And so that was the pervasive kind of mantra that went through as all the first and second generation Japanese were being evacuated and going through this process, was there wasn't anything we can do, it's happening, and then they would endure. And during the time my father was, you know, starting his farming and establishing his business, after the war, he purposely got involved in the community to make sure that he paved the way for us to live there and, you know, be known as people that wanted to contribute to the community. I was readily accepted by all my playmates, so there wasn't anything, you know, that I felt uncomfortable about. Some things were amusing, like somebody had mentioned to me, you and your sister look alike, and we don't think we look anything alike, and, you know, nobody's ever said that. And I said, oh, really? And I said, what's similar? And they go, well, You look familiar, you know, you look similar, you know, through your eyes. And I'm thinking, we both have classic Asian eyes. As a third generation Japanese American, I feel pretty distant growing up outside Seattle in the all-white community I was in. Our parents didn't send us to Japanese school, and they only spoke English to us. The only time they spoke Japanese was when they had conversations they didn't want us to know about. If you don't speak a language, there's a lot of the culture you miss. They were on this kick to make sure that we were kind of all American and assimilated totally into the American culture, because, you know, they felt that that would be important for us, so we wouldn't have to face the prejudice and discrimination that they had to go through. So yeah, overall, I've been able to feel like I've had the advantage of being Japanese, and it hasn't, you know, been a deterrent, or I haven't had any, you know, direct discrimination because of that.
That was Susan Churchill talking about what it was like to grow up as a Japanese American after World War II. She spoke with Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman. A discussion on recognizing racism will take place during Community in Unity on Wednesday at 7 p.m. at our studios in Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Business Administration program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.